Now it's time to generate and run the test cases. So I'll first generate them. And for that, I have a machine in Cord called, again, Test Suite, as yesterday, that says construct test cases using the short test strategy. And it uses the model program with two jobs pattern, one that I've just shown. So when I first explore that machine, you'll see that we get many more tests than we got yesterday when we were testing from a finite state machine. See, there are many tests here. Oh, that was too much. There are many tests here, but each of them is a sequence that starts with two adds, gets the info, deletes, adds again, and then finally deletes the two jobs that it had created, right? And those are all tests. One way to see that is if I zoom out again, you'll see they are all the same length because they all come from this same sequence. Of course, it's not true that any scenario determines a single sequence length, right? The scenario could have this ORs, or it could have question marks, meaning optional action. So sometimes it will appear and sometimes not, and so on. But these are all the same length. So once I've done this, I can go ahead and generate tests from this machine here. The machine is already marked as test enabled in this column because in the config, in the code file, it said test enable equals true. So I'm able to generate tests in Exploration Manager for this machine.
Nico, what does the short test strategy dictate there exactly?
The question is, what does the short test strategy dictate here? The answer is, again, what we're trying to do is to cover all possible steps in our model. The question is, Spec Explorer is building these sequences. At some point, it hits an accepting state. And the question is, should it stop there, or should it try to keep going and build a longer test case until it cannot go on? So short test means basically when you hit an accepting state, stop there. It has some configurations that one can do to make it stop before or after, but basically it means when you hit an accepting state, stop there, spit that test case, and keep going, and you will end up having shorter tests, but more of them, right? I can set this to long tests, given that this is this has a loop. I might be able to get, what did I do? Okay. Yes?
I thought the long test wouldn't make much of a difference here because anyway we are predicting the strategy, right? The sequence.
The question is, when you have a fixed sequence, will it make sense to do long or short tests? Well, it might, because remember that even if we are saying we want to stop after having done all this in the model program, that determines determines a loop, a cycle. So when you add some jobs and then delete some jobs, go back to a previous state, and from that state, even if it's accepting, you can keep going. So sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. We can see that with another example. This isn't very interesting because I think I ended up having pretty much the same thing with both strategy. Yes?
The example yesterday would have one sequence.
Right, the example we showed yesterday, the stopwatch would have created a single sequence, even if we determine in our pattern how to slice the model. When we construct test cases, even from this sliced model that has a cycle, we could keep going and build a longer set of test cases. Anyway, I've already generated test cases, which means if I now go to test view, I'll have a list of the generated test cases. In Visual Studio 2010, one should always refresh this list because it's cached. And then I can select them all. And now I can run them. Actually, I am running, this is in fact invoking, now it's the first time when the adapter is used. For the whole thing we did before, the adapter didn't matter, and now it does matter. Because the test cases, I'll show one the code for one of these test cases. The test case is actually calling the adapter. See, it's calling adapter.addService.addJob with certain parameters. Then it will assign the return value to a temp variable, and also the out parameter will be assigned to a temporary variable. So after doing this, these temporary variables will be compared with assert r equal, will be compared to the expected values that the model had predicted, right? So this is comparing temp 0 to 1 and comparing temp 1 to 2 to true, and the result will be that if some of them don't match, we'll see this message here saying there's... That's the oracle. That's the oracle. The comparison is being done here. But see how this is not using at all the state of the model. It just hard-coded what the model said the test cases should expect. Okay, let's try to wrap up because I think I'm over time. Yes?
In the test sequence that you showed, the requirement state is requirement 0 and 2. What does that indicate?
The question is, In the test sequence that I've shown, there are these calls to a checkpoint in the manager saying, if you got this far, you have verified this requirement. The requirement was provided in the model, remember? So I had this, in the model, I had this capture statement saying, if you get this far, you have checked one requirement, this requirement here. So the result of that is that after running my tests, hopefully all my tests have passed. These tests are actually using the scheduling service on my local machine and scheduling the jobs and then querying it, deleting them, and so on. So if I right-click one of these and say I want to view the results, the results will contain these checkpoints. So this is a text file, and it goes also to the output, so I can check which requirements have been covered by my test when running it.
So essentially, your test sequence should state requirements 2 and 2, right? Because you're checking for both the requirements.
The question is, should requirement 1 and requirement 2 appear in all my test sequences? The answer is yes, I'm checking both. So if you see this sequence here, it says requirement 1, and then requirement 2, again requirement 1, again requirement 2. Can I what, sorry?
To the spec explorer.
Oh, sure. So you wanted to see the generated
test
sequence?
No, the test sequence where it...
okay, got it. So if I go back to the exploration, I know now what the question is. So if I go to the exploration of the test suite... Where is it? No. Did I have it there? If I did, I missed it. I'll explore again. So the question is, why don't we see the captured requirements as part of the sequences here if there were captured requirements? And the, yes?
Below you see requirements 0 and 2, right?
Add job. I don't see it here, right?
No.
So
the states, the steps, then the requirements.
Here, I don't see it, do you?
No, not there, not there.
On the screen.
Below. On the screen.
Below.
Requirements.
Down the scroll bar.
The scroll bar.
Oh, here. I got it. So, yes, what we see here is there were two requirements covered in the whole test suite, of which we're seeing none here. So, 0/2 means two requirements were covered, but they are not displayed currently. The reason why they are not displayed is because my view, my default view, doesn't show requirements. See, display requirements is set to false. So if I want to see the requirements in the graph, I can create a new view So I'll say new here and set display requirements, here it is, to true. I'll change the name of this view to with requirements. I'll apply it. Okay. And now I should see under every step the requirements captured in that step. If I'm not seeing the requirements, there's a way still to see them. So if I go back to the default view and I click one step, I get the list of the requirements captured in that step, right? Okay, so and I'll try to go really quickly over the remaining part. This was one question: how do I check errors? And the fact is that we want to test for errors if we know what the error should result in. So when we do model-based testing, it's not that we will just generate errors to see if something goes wrong. We should know in advance as a requirement, so there should be a requirement saying this is what should happen if you provide invalid values. So is there a requirement here? Yes. So hopefully we will have something like this. Requirement 3, adding a job with an invalid time must result in an error. Right? That's a requirement. So we can code for that requirement in our model. This add job now has been extended by saying if the time is negative or the time is bigger than the job, than the maximum time, then set the ID to 0 and capture this requirement. It has been checked, right? Okay, and return false, because so far add job always returned true. Now it should return false. So this lets me test for requirements. Will my model test for requirements, the one I have explored so far? The answer is no, because I'm not providing invalid arguments, invalid parameter values. The only parameter values for the time that I'm providing are 340,000 and 600,000, and they are not error values. So what I need to do, as I have in the slide, is to slice for errors. So for example, I could go back to my configuration and say I will, instead of 340, let's try -1. That's an invalid value. Okay, I'm almost there, because if I explore this model, this machine that has the model program with two jobs, I'll see, you should immediately see a problem. So there is a problem that there are these states here that are non-accepting end states. That means we got to a point where this is not an accepting state, so this is not a state that the modeler considered to be a valid state to end the test, but there's no way to continue from here. And the reason is the model doesn't know how to go on once that it has added two jobs. Well, not exactly the model. So the model knows what to do, right? But the problem is I'm here combining the model with a scenario. And if we go back to the scenario, remember the scenario says add two jobs, then get job info. And the problem is if I add it, after I've added two invalid jobs, there is no way to get job info. Right? So the model knows that there's nothing to get job info for and stops there, right? And the scenario hasn't finished. And as I said before, the only accepting states are the ones that finish, that actually exercise the whole scenario. So we have a problem there. But this is not as big a problem as the bounds, because actually I'm fairly happy with this model here. I would be able to test from it. I just don't want to go over these paths here. right? So these paths here that have two invalid jobs, I don't care about those, right? Yes, I have a question.
If you try to add two invalid jobs, you're still in the ascending state, though, right? Because you still have zero jobs, so your job count is zero.
Well, but it changes the job IDs. So there is a change. Let's compare them. That's a good point. So let's compare this state here. I'm left-clicking this state, and then right-clicking the initial state and saying compare. And the difference is, oh, well, the problem is it's non-accepting, actually, anyway. And this one is accepting. The problem, the reason why they are not merging is the scenario again. Okay. So the scenario tells me it's not the same. After having done two ads, you still have something to do. So that's what, let me show the state comparison. That's why I have two different descriptions. That's what we call control state that tells Spec Explorer you're not done yet. So it's not, you're not in the same state because not, you cannot do the same things from these two. Because the scenario imposes that from the initial state, you can only do ad job, but from this state, after adding two jobs, you should be able to do something else. In this case, get info, right? But yes, it's a good question. If I remove the scenario, then it would go back, and it wouldn't be a non-accepting end. Yes?
So when it's doing the get job, is it doing the job information for a particular job or for all the added jobs so far?
The get job has a parameter. No, any of the added jobs. So let's look at that. So if we go back to the model, the model says you can get job info for any ID that is in use. That means that when you get to a state, you will have one step doing get job info for each possible, for each existing added job. They will be parallel. It's not that it will be one after the other. You will see one for each. Then you go to the next state, and if in that state the same jobs are still there, then you have again all possible get job infos. That's it. So in this particular case, it's doing a single get job info because when I do get job info in my scenario, there's only one job. Actually, no. In this case, there are two. So there will be two get job infos at this point. Then I delete one job. There's only one. I add job. I get job info. I will get two get job infos from that state. See?
When you don't specify any parameter there on the first get job info.
Right. The
so
question is yes.
Getting?
The question is, I'm not specifying any parameter to any of the actions in the pattern. So where does Spec Explorer get those parameters? The answer is from nowhere, because remember when I explore this scenario, here it is, there is no value for any parameter. When I combine this scenario with the model program, I'm effectively restricting the model program, which has parameters for all its steps, to only these steps here. But the steps come already with parameters from the model program, and when unification is performed between this action and the one that has the values, we will get a single step. That's what the parallel composition, the double bar, does, where we will get a single step merging both steps with the values unified from both steps.
Yes, but so if you see the sequence here, it does two adds and then it does one get.
Right.
So is the get it's doing just a decision made by Spec Explorer?
No, it comes from my scenario. My scenario says add, then get.
But what I'm asking is, for which job is it doing a get?
It's doing it for no job. There is no job, because remember, this is just a scenario. It's completely arbitrary.
When you combine it, after you do the combination, right?
After I'm combining it, what I'm saying basically is, after having done two jobs, you will be in a state in your model. Select in that state only the outgoing transitions that are get job info. And the transitions already have parameters, have values for the parameters, because this is a model, and the model program has provided values for them. So what I'm doing here is just selecting those that do get job info at that point. Yes, what's that?
Can you just show that?
Yes. Here, after having added one job and adding one job, I'm doing get job info, as I promised, there are two get job info, one for job one and one for job two, and of course the info is the right info because these states, the state in the composition, are rich states. They do have the map with all the commands and values, right? Okay. So now I'm able to, as I said, I'm at the point where I'm almost happy with my exploration result, because there are some infeasible paths. There are some paths that don't end up in an accepting state. But as I said, I don't care about these particular paths in my testing. So what I'll do is I'll say construct test cases, but before that, do construct, for example, here I can do it in both places, but I'll do it here because it looks better. So only select accepting paths in this model, in this behavior here. So this should be 4. Accepting paths for this behavior. So now if I re-explore model program with two jobs pattern, it will not have the non-accepting end states, and it will be in fact testing some error conditions, right? So there are some errors here. When the time is -1, then it should expect false as a return value and so on. I won't run these tests because we don't have time, but basically they will work because that's how the implementation behaves. Sorry, that's the wrong one. The only thing I want to explain before we end is that we cheated a little bit in our ad service model, because recall what requirement one said. It said when adding a job, the server must return a unique job identifier. Now, which job identifier? As I've just shown in the exploration, the job identifiers are 1 and 2, basically. But we don't know if that's what the server will provide. The server, when we're running and you add a job, you say add, and you provide all the parameters for a job, you get back an identifier, and it's basically an arbitrary identifier. We don't know what it will be. And so, of course, the model cannot predict that, right? So that's where we sort of cheated. So what we do is we let the model choose identifiers, like 1 and 2. And that's, let me go back to remember that the model has, in the add job, it does allocate unique ID. If I go to this method here, there's a fairly arbitrary, again, way to generate an identifier. It says if it's -1, it will go over all identifiers in use, and it will select the first number that has never been used and provide that, right? So what happens is the adapter will not get those identifiers. So why did it work? Right? The model says, okay, add one job and you should get ID 1. Now the adapter is doing that on the server and it's getting another number, right? So the reason it worked is because we used the abstract identifier pattern. So the abstract identifier pattern has the adapter remap model identifiers to physical identifiers, the ones that it gets from the model to the ones that it gets from the implementation. And it ensures that the mapping is injective. I have a diagram for this. So if it has already assigned number 1 to identifier hexadecimal FFFC, then assign identifier 2 to FA01, then assign identifier 3 and 4 to other parameters, and then all of a sudden, when it's expecting identifier 4, it gets a different identifier, the one that was assigned to identifier 1, it will say, no, I cannot map it here. That's an error. So the adapter is keeping this list, actually it's a map from a dictionary, from identifiers it got from the model and identifiers it got from the implementation, and whenever the model tells it to provide an existing identifier, it maps it back, and the other way around. Whenever it gets an identifier from the implementation, it either delivers to the test the associated number or generates a new number if it didn't have one, right? So they have to match. The algorithms on both sides must match. Yes, I have a question.
What about you model race condition? Race condition.
The question is, how do you model a race condition?
Yes. There's only one identifier, and the two thread, one, two update.
So the question is, how do you model a race condition where two threads want to use the same identifier? And the answer is, you just model. You model both threads, and you let them use identifiers. And in this case, yes? Right. We will explain that in next session. But basically, this is similar to how do you model errors. Well, in order to model an error, you have to start from a requirement that tells you what to expect in certain condition, and then you go to your model, make sure that you make that condition happen, as I did for the error, and you tell the adapter what to expect in that case. If you don't know what to expect, there's not much to test, right? So you need to know what to expect, and you try to model that, and if you want to really force race condition in your implementation, you would have to figure out a way to do it from your adapter, right? To actually produce that race condition in order to be able to test it. Wolfgang says we'll see that tomorrow. Today, in the afternoon, sorry. There's no tomorrow. There is tomorrow, but there's no class. Hopefully. Right. So, typical operations you perform with abstract identifiers are binding an abstract identifier to a concrete identifier, translating when you get a known abstract or concrete identifier, and unbinding if you want to reuse the identifier.
So, can you show where that is in the adapter?
Yeah, sure. The key here is that model and adapter need to agree on the algorithm that is used to assign new numbers. So when I do add job, you'll see that it's using free IDs here and changing the free IDs, and where's the return value is called job IDs. Yeah, it's using the first free ID that it finds and removing the free ID. And it will do the same when you delete jobs. So it's basically this binding and unbinding that we're doing in a map in the adapter. The map is declared up here. It's a list of free IDs that you can use. Basically, this is it, and we keep them in sync. Right? We've done this several times for our protocols, because this is a common case in protocols, and it works as long as you're using the same algorithm in both the identifier and the adapter and the model, of course. And if you don't, then you will get some errors that you have to debug to understand that there's a problem between model and adapter and not in the implementation, right? You can debug your test cases using the debugger in Visual Studio when you run them. Okay, so that's it. I think we're over time, so I returned Wolfgang's favor from yesterday. going all the way to 3. I'm sorry about that. And we'll see you in, I guess, 15 minutes for the next session. Thank you very much.